Welcome to It's All Journalism. So we were wondering, is there life for the novel online? And if so, what can journalism learn from it? One project is trying to reincarnate the novel in online form through serialized fiction. Plimpton is a literary studio founded by former New York Times reporter Jenny H. Lee and author Yael Goldstein Love. We spoke with Jenny, who joined us from San Francisco. Welcome, Jenny.
Hi, I'm excited to be here.
So we're excited to have you. First of all, can you describe how Plimpton works and how you and Yael came up with the idea in the first place?
So our vision at Plimpton is sort of to see like the parallels between television and how that differs from movies, and to bring that to the written word. So what television dramas are to movies, Plimpton serials are to novels. So we think that there's a really exciting possibility in digital publishing to bring a story that is ongoing and growing and that can be delivered to your e-reader, whether or not it's a Kindle or an iPad or a Nook. Our, you know, vision is to have you have these sort of shorter installments, you know, anywhere between, you know, 8,000 words to maybe 20,000 words, and they're each individually a story, but they also stream together into a much larger narrative, just like television shows today, like with Mad Men and The Wire or Downton Abbey, kind of have these, like, you know, magnificent arcs, but at the same time, they have these really great character-driven plots within each installment episode.
So what's your, to sort of tap into your analogy here of between television and comparing it to movies, it's doing something that's episodic, but then all tied together so that people can approach it individually. You know, I'll download a particular segment, be able to get the reward of that, but then if I want to continue on and read the larger story, I can do that.
Yeah, it's very much like just, I mean, obviously it's sometimes better and more fulfilling to read the entire arc. Or another good analogy would be comic books. Like, they each individually are, you know, an issue or installment or an episode, but at the same time you have sort of this larger arc and this larger universe of characters that you get to explore and deepen with each, with each episode.
Now, this isn't something that's really a new idea in literature. I mean, you know, Dickens was writing in installments in newspapers, and, you know, Arthur Conan Doyle, they're doing, you know, short stories and segments, and not that those were necessarily tied together, except in a larger, Sherlock Holmesian, whatever. You know, is that kind of where you got your inspiration, is sort of what earlier models that people had done in print?
Yeah, definitely we're inspired by, like, the great novels of the late 19th century, so great number of novels in Europe and even in the United States that we know and love today were originally serialized. So obviously Dickens' work, you know, starting with the Pickwick Papers, which is sort of like the breakout hit of serialization, but even Uncle Tom's Cabin originally was serialized. And then the Anna Karenina is also a serialized novel, and the Brothers Kazimierz. So what happened during that era and why that was true is the money to pay writers to be writers at that point came from periodicals that needed a way to bring readers back and back and back to the periodicals, and hence the serialized sort of novel was born. And so, and later on, the writers would take the sort of the episodes and then they would smooth it out. So what we see today in our bound books is not exactly what ran sort of on first pass way back when. Kind of come further than that, right? So television, to a certain extent, has, and especially television in the last, you know, seven to eight years, has really taken serial that was inspired back then and sort of, like, you know, moved it and taken it to the next level. And I think some of the great best writing anywhere right now actually might be in some of these more character-driven, high-end dramas.
Yeah, it's amazing how many different people I hear saying that in all different types of fields. And, you know, from movies and TV, they're all like, you know, you got to watch television now. I mean, things, amazing writing is going on. And I think there's a lot of lessons
in
storytelling.
But very much, it's not on network television.
No.
So, you know, it is on AMC and HBO. And in part, I have to think that the economics of being on one of these cable channels allows them to be more risky than if you have to appeal to the great numbers with network television. So in the same way where one thing that's really notable about digital fiction and LinkedIn is that fundamentally our business model and our economics are different than in the print-first world, right? Like, if you are a traditional publisher, your first mission right now is to get a physical object into stores where people will buy it. And so there's printing and there's shipping, right? And there you have a sales force. And that really adds up and is expensive, which is why books start, you know, at $6 and kind of go up from there, you know, to $25, $29 for sort of the very prestigious hardcover releases every fall.
At the same time that this is going on with, you know, we're still talking sort of about TV and how the way that relates to this is, while this is going on, there's a revolution that's occurring in online content for delivering that into people's homes, you know, on their TVs or on their iPads, you know, on their mobile devices, where they're able to download the whole series or download episodes and things for, you know, sort of a fraction of maybe what it would cost to, like, download a movie or something. So while the serialized content is sort of being created, you're also getting, at the same time, you're getting a delivery system that's sort of reaching people in a different way than traditionally had happened. And I think, you know, that's exciting. But I think also sort of speaks to sort of what you're trying to do is, you know, deliver books and deliver storytelling in a different way.
Yeah. And it seems to cut out the middleman, too. Like you're talking about, you don't have the printing costs, the publishing costs. I mean, you're able to work directly with the authors. And I'm wondering how that works with the business model. Like, what are you charging and how much of a cut does the author get? And how are you funding all this?
So you don't always directly work with the authors. In fact, actually, some of our most talented writers come just through agents who are the most amazing talent scouts and gatekeepers in the entire literary publishing world, and they, as they have been and will continue to be. So the way that the model works is slightly different than print. So because we don't have, we're a smaller company, essentially you give us a smaller advance. We still do give advance, but you give a much more generous royalty payment on the back end. So in some ways, that works in part because any of the digital publishers, like the platforms like Kindle or Nook and Google Play, the cut that they take of the price is usually between 10% and 30%. And so in some cases, for low pricing, it jumps all the way up to 65%. What happens is, because you don't have paper, more of the cost can actually be distributed to the author and the publisher versus just like the platform that kind of carried you there. The way we find our authors is, you know, through people that we know, who we know to be strong authors. And in a way, the early generation of writers were along for the ride. So the first generation of serials that we did were actually published through the Amazon Serials program, which is different than I think other places are going to try with serials. And what that does is you just pay once for a single title, and it grows over time, so you get your episodes delivered automatically. And the starting price for the Kindle serials in this case were each $1.99, and then you get like 5 or 6 or 7 episodes for that. And I could see that price actually not being a static price. So like, it's $1.99 when there's only one episode out, but it might go $2.99 when there's 3 episodes out. And like when it hits, and it's a final book, it might jump to another price as well. So I know that pricing model is still very much like up for experimentation, and no one knows actually what will happen over time. But I would say that what I've seen other people do in terms of Kindle direct publishing with serialization is they'll sell an episode for $1.99, but then what happens is when season quote one or volume one is done, they'll bundle it together into like a much longer work and then sell that for like $5.99.
That's sort of like what you mentioned comic books before, that they're, every month a new issue comes out, but there's also been a growth in the graphic novel collection where they'll take a year's worth of comics or a story arc and they'll package that. And then so, they'll be able to have that on the bookshelf, and then there's been sort of development of people who are going for the collection as opposed to just following it monthly. Just being able to sort of approach the content in different ways and actually being able to monetize it in different ways as well.
Yes. Now it's and you definitely, at least under the current model of like sort of distribution through Amazon and this, you do better, you keep more of the money above a certain, like above $2, you keep much a greater percentage of the money, not just like in absolute terms, but in percentage terms.
I know one of the things that's been out there, you worked at the New York Times, and mm-hmm. one of the conversations that's been in, you know, journalism and how to basically make money on the web is sort of the paywall aspect. How is this different than sort of a paywall type thing where you would buy a subscription or, you know, you need to go to a website to get this content? It's you're just really particularly going in for a particular author, a particular work or whatever, sort of a selling it out piecemeal.
This is very different than, I guess, the new supermodel online. There are a couple of reasons. Like, one, this is entertainment, and so people are more readily and willing to be paid to be entertained now than they are to be informed, which may be a sad commentary on our society, but it's generally kind of true. So that's to a certain extent you see that's why music and iTunes, television shows, and, you know, ebooks sort of have taken off. And the other really significant thing is people are used to paying for books, right? And so this is what they were lucky, or publishers so far have been in some ways lucky that people are used to paying for books. So this is just a shorter book. So they're like, oh, well, I used to pay $10 or $25 for a book, but now this is smaller. So I will take that mentality and sort of port it over to the, like, a shorter work. So I'll pay $1.99 or $2.99. So you're moving them from a different place. Whereas with journalism, because just the way that the web has evolved over time, people are used to the basically news sites being free. I mean, this is something that sort of the big thought is this, right? There are news organizations that will pop up that are not the legacy newspapers that are willing and have a business model where they can report and write for basically that's advertising supported native to the web. One important kind of parallel to see is that just like in the last, like about 10 years ago, you saw, first you had the institutions of journalism, like New York Times and Time Magazine and CNN. Then, like in 03, 04, you saw this total explosion of bloggers, specifically, you know, political was very vigorous to the point where the DNC actually credentialed bloggers for the presidential nominating convention. And then a couple years later, you saw the professionalization of blogs, where you took some of that, like, digital mindset, but then you moved it and combined it with institution scale and, like, professionalism. So you're seeing that same kind of, like, third-tier effect happening in publishing, where first you have the legacy publishers, and then, largely thanks to Amazon and Kindle, you have this total Wild West Cambrian explosion of self-publishing, to the point where of the top 100 selling things ever on Kindle, 27 of them actually came through Kindle's, like, direct publishing program, self-published. And so now we're seeing this generation of publishers, not just Plimpton, but Byliner and Atavist, who are digital. So they take some of the nimbleness from digital publishing and then combine it with professional, like, production qualities and scale and business models. And we don't know if it actually works yet. I mean, we were lucky because of the first generation of serials, we were profitable, thanks to that deal. But we're still trying to experiment over the long term. But it is different in part because the mentality of the consumer is different, and also Amazon kind of kickstarted that ecosystem where you have your credit card already in their files, so you just say buy now. And the fact that they had created this whole ecosystem and, like, universe where most of the stuff that you would want was both available and you had to pay for it, you know, basically meant that there was an economy for it. Whereas just newspapers and whatever on the web just were kind of roaming free, and people are used to basically Googling or, like, going to the website and seeing stuff. The other thing is newspapers and journalism institutions, as much as they charge for subscriptions, in large part were advertising-based. Mm-hmm. And so where their pain point really is the loss of the advertising revenue from their print editions. Whereas the thing about a book is the transaction value is actually very clear and very one-to-one. I'm going to pay you money for this content that I want, for this book that I want. Whereas that was not the pure economics of, like, even magazines. Like, I'm paying you some really reduced subscription fee that's less than sometimes even the cost of the paper and getting that to my mailbox. because it is largely subsidized by the advertisers who want to get in front of their eyeballs, right? So many, in many cases, magazines basically give away very cheap subscriptions in order to keep their circulation numbers up as a guarantee for the advertisers. And so there are many masters in that business model, where there's a much clearer business model here.
I was just thinking before when you were talking about Amazon and people purchasing things and having their credit card there, it's almost the impulse, you know, appealing to the impulse buyer out there, you know, saying, oh, I recognize this author, I recognize this book, or this is on a subject, this is on vampires, I want to read about it. So I'm going to just click on it because it's so easy to do. But anyway, one of the other things we wanted to sort of touch on about what Plimpton is doing is the social media aspect of it, that you can sort of appeal to your friends and see what books they're reading and what their top 10 list, what they've downloaded, and sort of share that. Can you sort of talk about what you're doing there in the social media realm?
So one of the most important things reading, and I think this is interesting, was the series don't have standalone websites. They actually roll over to a dedicated Facebook page. So we thought about, like, so we have a title, for example, called, like, The Many Lives of Lilith Lane. So I'm like, okay, so does The Many Lives of Lilith Lane stand as an individual, domain website? And I realized everything that I would want, a Facebook page at this point basically gives me. If you go to manylives.lilithlane.com, it actually goes to a Facebook page, in part because that's where they have, like, this entire infrastructure where people become fans, people can follow, this is where you can post photos, this is where they can comment and have street, you know, kind of conversation among each other. And the other thing, of course, that's really powerful in social media, and one of the most important things actually for books traditionally, is that the word of mouth really drives everything, right? And books much more so than movies, in part because the marketing budget for books has always been sort of like one or two order magnitudes less than that for film, where, you know, basically for film they can go out and buy billboards and commercials and, you know, advertisements. Mm-hmm. But just publishing as an industry always needed, you know, like Kite Rider, for example, was a book that sort of became a bestseller through reading groups. And so what's wonderful about social media for young publishers is that you can have the authors get out there and interact in a much more direct and intimate way than it was, you know, then in television or film, right? Because it is their creation, their mind. We've been impressed with some of the success that individual authors who have sort of self-published have had in terms of creating their followings, and we're trying to figure out, like, oh, is that a toolkit that we can help our authors learn in terms of when someone comments about or has, like, feedback on your Facebook page or even your Amazon review, we definitely, or on Goodreads, another great place, we encourage authors to go in. And so I think Goodreads, which has 12 million registered users, is actually one of the most vibrant places for books to be discovered and to spread in terms of getting their attention from a viral perspective. Because if someone adds a title onto their to-read list, or that they are reading it or they want to read it, their friends get a notice that, you know, of that case. So we're definitely trying to put a lot of attention onto Goodreads in terms of figuring out, like, okay, what are the best ways to engage with readers through that? And we haven't completely figured it out in terms of what the magic formula is, but we're trying lots of different experiments to see what gets traction.
You know, there's still something very romantic to me about picking up a print book and curling up and opening it up. Do you think there's still a place for that type of reading experience, I guess, you know, with a physical object in your hand?
Oh, yeah, no, totally. I actually love reading print books, and almost preferred in some cases, depending on what kind of situation. Like, the great thing about a print book is it's like a commitment. Like, the thing is, if I'm on my iPad, I'm like, oh, like, let's see what else is on Twitter or you know, Angry Birds. And I have sometimes found myself being really distracted when I'm trying to read on, like, you know, one of my electronic devices. Whereas the printed word doesn't morph on the page, and so you're making this emotional and mental commitment to the book. And I love the smell and the feel and just, like, the texture of books. And I always think that there's going to be space for that. In fact, the book will become a more and more cherished object. Like, it'll be a, like, the books that we will see will be more beautifully produced as a result. And you're already seeing that with, like, my friend's book, Mr. Penumbra's 24-Hour Bookstore. The cover actually glows in the dark, which is really fantastic. And so, in fact, in order to make the book more appealing, you have to up that production value, right? Mm. And the other thing that I love about books is you can see them on, like, a shelf. So, like, there's nice things about Goodreads that, like, people far away can see what is on your sort of, quote, shelf. But it's weird to go to someone's, you know, home, and you can't, if you see their Kindle, you don't actually know what they're reading, and you don't know that much about their personality, right? Like, and so there's something really beautiful about seeing, like, that shelf of what they've bought, in theory, what they've read, because, you know, especially, like, say, if you're dating someone new, for example, it's very, very telling, right? And then, like, the best thing about books, of course, is, like, when you're on the airplane, you don't have to, quote, turn it off for takeoff and landing, and that is, like, immensely valuable.
Yeah, I guess maybe, you know, to be sexist, maybe it's because I'm the man in the room that I although I appreciate books, I don't have the romantic relationship with them. I love books, but I also find them that they can also be kind of annoying, and in that they remind you constantly that you need to get back to them, and they're always, you always see them with a Kindle. It's hidden.
So much guilt associated.
Yeah,
with
I have a lot of guilt. So I have a big stack of books, and I'm like, oh, I got to read those sometimes, and it says more about me than I think probably it says about books. So let's sort of wrap this up here. What are you hoping to get to accomplish or get out of here? What do you see as the future for
What we're absolutely passionate about is the nurturing of new talent and voices and connecting them with an audience, right? So there's something very, as the large publishers have become part of conglomerates, their business model has sort of shifted where there's, you know, more money being put behind the big titles and sort of less what we would call like development money that's nurturing novelists and fiction writers through their first, second novels, and maybe it's their third novel that takes off, right? And so historically, that space of creating the next generation of, like, you know, the future Dickens or the Hemingways, like, we are guardians of our culture, right, for the ages. There's so much literature that has been passed down through both, you know, centuries. We editors and publishers historically think of themselves as guardians of the culture and sort of nurturers of the voice of their generation that will be preserved, you know, down centuries. And so it's really important to have a sustainable business model and, like, a way to allow writers to have the freedom to write. And that's what we're trying to figure out here. Like, is there a way that we can, you know, create the way economics such that we can allow the most talented, you know, and gifted writers of this generation to continue to do so and maybe have the room to breathe and grow. And so we're crossing our fingers to expand that.
That was Jenny Eight-Lee, co-founder of Plimpton, a literary studio that features serialized fiction online. You can find out more at plimpton.com. And you can hear more podcasts of It's All Journalism at itsalljournalism.com.